Hello and welcome to the international edition of my podcast, Rad Ab. I'm your host, Linda Rad, and I interview entrepreneurs who I admire and look up to. I want to know more about their business and work ethics, and not only the entrepreneurial endeavors, but also what drives them, what inspires them, and how do they become so outstanding at what they're doing. I believe you need so much more than just talent and skills to be successful in business. So let's find out what secrets our entrepreneurs will reveal to us. This episode is sponsored by MediaTek Hub Potsdam. It is one of 12 digital hubs in Germany, initiated by the Federal Ministry of Economics and Energy, and the only one with a focus on media tech. It encompasses a working space, an accelerator, and an annual conference, and I highly recommend you check it out if you want to start a business or if you want to scale. I'm an entrepreneur myself, and our startup Fragments used to be located at the MediaTek Lab in Potsdam. I will link to their website in my show notes. Today, I'm joined by Ella Kellen, award-winning journalist and filmmaker. She worked as a foreign correspondent at Al Jazeera and produced numerous documentaries for Al Jazeera's 101 East program. Ella was selected for a prestigious John S. Knight Fellowship for Journalism Innovation at Stanford University, and a few years ago, she started her own company called Headset Studio. When I met Ella more than 5 years ago, I think now it is, we would always meet up at the Berlin co-working space factory and talk about how virtual reality is going to change journalism and how it can help tell better stories. And I remember Ella always went to different international conferences to see the latest and best VR experiences, and she always had a very clear understanding of what immersive technologies can do for journalism, and not only for journalism, but also for society as a whole. So I'm very excited to speak with her today. Hi, Ella.
Hi, Linda.
So nice to talk to you.
That's very generous that I have a good understanding of immersive technologies in journalism. I think we're all trying to still grapple with understanding how immersive technologies are going to affect journalism, I think. But thank you for that very gracious introduction.
Well, I think it's true. You've been quite busy over the past years, and I know you spent some time in Lebanon, and now you're living in Brussels. Before we speak about Headset Studio, I wanted to know, as an entrepreneur and leading a team as a CEO of a company, what would you say have been some of the biggest challenges throughout this pandemic so far?
Oh, like most companies, everything. We were pretty well set up as a digital first kind of agency when COVID hit. So it was not a challenge in terms of managing the team remotely because we were already, you know, all over the world. Most of our dev team is in the UK. My co-founder, Kate, is in London, and I was in Beirut. So we were pretty well set up for dealing with that remotely. What has changed particularly is dealing with clients. So we weren't able to go face-to-face into newsrooms and talk to people. And then the distribution of a VR product, which is a very new technology for most of these newsrooms, even if they have studios that are creating content, it was still a very new way of delivering training. This was a real challenge. Mm-hmm. So it's been slower than we would like, but I'm impatient. And we managed to, there were benefits as well, I think, to COVID, it's fair to say, particularly around product development. And what we ended up creating was really very much shaped by COVID.
Mm. Okay, so we'll get into that in a minute. Maybe you can tell us more about Headset Studio.
Sure. So Headset is a immersive technology company that makes virtual reality training for journalists, but also now humanitarians and diplomats, and even the private sector, for people who work in high-risk environments. So we develop basically immersive scenarios that help you prepare both physically and emotionally for what happens when you're in the midst of a big story like a protest or a natural disaster. Even things like digital security we have in development and trauma-sensitive reporting, so that you can really practice in a safe space where mistakes are free. And this really grew out of an experience that my co-founder Kate had in 2011 in Libya. She was a journalist covering the fall of Gaddafi, and her cameraman, who is now her husband, Olivier, was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. And Kate and I had worked together through in Myanmar. We'd done quite a lot of, we'd done all the protests in Bangkok. We felt very prepared because we'd done the kind of best hostile environment training that journalists can do. Mm. But in that moment, Kate completely froze and didn't know what to do. And that really started a long journey for her with post-traumatic stress, you know, having your agency taken away from you in the moment, even though, you know, it's your body's natural reaction. It's a protective mechanism when you go into that freeze reaction. But really, she blamed herself for a lot of years, and it was a very tricky thing. I, as you mentioned, had spent some time at Stanford where I had learned about virtual reality in the virtual human interaction lab there. And I had sort of looked at this technology and thought, well, I'm a serious filmmaker. This is for games and this isn't for me. But then, you know, fast forward a few years and Kate and I were working on some immersive projects for news delivery, content delivery, which was a Google Digital News Initiative grant, our funded project. And we sort of put two and two together and we thought, oh, hang on, this could really be used by our colleagues to help them understand what it feels like in that moment, because you really don't know how you're going to react until you do it. And we know as journalists ourselves that the best training doesn't come from sitting in a classroom or even running around doing these fake scenarios where they try and, you know, fake kidnap you, etc. The best knowledge comes from doing it yourself or from learning from other colleagues who have been there and done that. So we really just started with this idea, could we make immersive scenarios that would provide that benefit for journalists in their newsrooms or in their homes during COVID, wherever they are and whenever they need it? And so that was the kernel of the idea. We were both working full-time as journalists at the time. We didn't intend to start a startup and for it to become a company. But, you know, it was a side project. But really, it's taken over what both of us do. We both left journalism in 2018 to work full-time on this. And, it's just taken off ever since.
Ah, so you can actually do the training sessions or the VR sessions at home. You don't have to go anywhere and participate in a workshop or something?
Yeah, that's the whole idea, that you can deliver it completely remotely. You can also deliver it in person as part of regular training if you want to. But we envisage a world where all journalists have access to these headsets in the back of the newsroom or in their homes. And they're able to, you know, pre-deployment or before they go on a trip, put on the headset, refresh their knowledge, and do it in a way that is much more trauma aware than the current training practices, and also, you know, helps protect them emotionally, which is why we're called headset, as in set your head.
When I look at your website, I can see some very impressive scenes from an immersive training session for journalists, and it is a half-day stress management and civil unrest session that you offer to plan how to cover violent protests. And it includes risk assessment and identifying threats. And it, like you said, it seems more relevant now than ever to be prepared as a journalist to go when you go into protests. and you know how to react or act when there's violent behavior all around you. And I don't know if you are still following German news, but there have been countless attacks on journalists over the summer during the so-called anti-COVID protests. When you try to find customers, is it difficult or is it rather easy? Because it's not like everybody is doing these immersive training sessions, right? It's at least not yet. It's still very new, still very specific. It takes time to develop these training sessions. How do you find your customers?
Yeah, so it's been a long process, and the Stress Management and Civil Unrest course is sort of our pilot product that we have only really just been deploying since March in the UK. And we've had a really long journey because we sort of thought, okay, we make the VR and we have the course that wraps around it, and that's it. We were really wrong. We had to handhold much more in terms of distribution and in terms of upskilling existing training staff, but also anyone in the newsroom. We want journalists to be able to deliver this to other journalists, because we found one of the most valuable parts of the course that people were really enjoying the most was the fact that we were journalists ourselves, and that they could, you know, access us and talk to us about, you know, our experiences. And so we really had to create basically an entire train the trainer package, if you like, which is part of our subscriptions, to be able to upskill people within the news organizations to deliver this, because we are a small company. We don't have the capacity to have, you know, heaps and heaps of trainers around the place. So finding customers, we're really at the beginning of this journey, Linda, to tell you the truth. We've operated so far like just completely by word of mouth. It helped that, you know, both Kate and I had worked for many of the world's biggest news agencies in the past, either as freelancers or staff. So we had connections in those places. And we started out with six news organizations working with their high-risk teams to develop the content. And so, you know, once that was finished, they were ready to start testing and deploying it for us. And, you know, those are news organizations like Vice, Reuters, AFP, and, you know, we really worked very closely with their teams to be able to develop content that was relevant to them. And so now we're at the beginning, you know, of a journey where we're trying to spread the word, and we're trying to embed this in all organizations in different countries around the world. We're even trying to think about how we would reversion this for different languages and different training scenarios. And so we can really extend the reach of what we're doing in a much more proactive way. So really, to answer your question in short, we're at the beginning of that customer finding journey. And, you know, so far we've been lucky with the connections that have come to us. And, you know, now we've really, you know, we're not entrepreneurs, we're journalists. And so Kate and I often joke that we literally are doing an MBA via Google. But setting up a sales process, for instance, has been something that is completely outside of our knowledge and our comfort zone, if I'm honest. But, you know, really, the way we're thinking about it now is that we have something that is solving a very important problem. Journalists, you know, are on a 24/7 front line now, whether it's, you know, physically covering unrest in, you know, the streets because of COVID protests, which is very relevant to our scenario, or on the front lines of Twitter, being, you know, the cyberbullying and harassment that goes on of journalists now. We really have a culture of, you know, people and members of the public, but also politicians attacking the media. And so we really have a solution to a problem, and we really look at it as, you know, now we have something that can help newsrooms and help journalists solve that.
Right. And I mean, you've mentioned before that media, that journalists go through trainings before they go into actually reporting in war zones, for example. How would you say the VR training differs from the traditional training, besides the fact that you can do it, you know, at the convenience of your home or you know, anywhere you want to? Where would you say lay the advantages of the VR training aspect, of the immersive technology aspect?
Yeah. So part of the problem with traditional hostile environment training is that it's only available to a very small subset of journalists. And these are usually the journalists who are deployed on big foreign assignments. You know, we, you know, would only be able to access that training if we were being sent to Iraq or Syria or, you know, some other kind of hostile environment. It's very war focused. It's run by predominantly former soldiers who have great knowledge of, you know, being in war zones and militaristic environments, but very little experience with actually being a reporter. And you have different objectives in that scenario. It was not at all diverse. It's mostly run by men and mostly run by men in Western countries. And really, the DNA of Headset is all about having a modular system where, with scenarios that are much more relevant. It's no good going and hearing, you know, learning about how to protect yourself on a military embed when actually the biggest problem that you're facing is, you know, anti-lockdown protesters or just generally being harassed on the street because you're carrying a camera. So we really wanted our scenarios to be much more relevant to the threats that journalists are facing today. And, you know, the current hostile environment training model was really set up around 20-something years ago after the Gulf War when journalists were embedding with armies. And so, you know, our scenarios are much more around things like protests, things like, you know, understanding like digital security, things like environmental catastrophes, because these, you know, it's a very small subset of journalists now who are running around in hostile environments and they have had the five-day training. We're not saying at all that the traditional, you know, week-long training course that you go to should be abolished. That should still exist for the journalists who need it. But if you're a desk-based producer sitting in Berlin and you're all of a sudden sent to cover a protest, but you've had zero access to any of this kind of training, then you're not equipped to be able to deal with whatever that scenario you know, throws up at you. We know that from, you know, when Kate and I started as journalists 20 years ago, the threat was something that you got on a plane to go and cover. Now it's very much on your doorstep wherever you are, from Beirut to Berlin or even here in Brussels. So we really wanted to make the scenarios relevant. The second point of difference in immersive training is that it really, we find, and we were surprised by this with our user research, but we find journalists find it more realistic and more emotionally impactful than the scenarios that are played out by actors. So if you go and do this, you know, the whole week-long training, you know, if you get a good course, you will have actors come in and, you know, pretend to run scenarios with you. And these, particularly as a woman, can be quite triggering and traumatic. You know, Kate and I have had various training scenarios where we were told things like, you know, you're the girl on the course, scream and, you know, I'm going to tell everyone I've raped you. Now, that benefits other people on the course because they've got a scenario happening around you. But as, you know, a young female journalist, it's probably something that's quite inappropriate and quite triggering for you. And so we wanted to create virtual scenarios where you don't need those actors and where we've spent a lot of time making you feel like you're actually there. And we do that in a very artistic way, I would say. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that in the beginning, Kate and I used to attend a lot of different virtual reality creative conferences, yeah. And we really picked up a lot of different techniques. And then we worked with different universities to test the effect of what we were doing. So our scenarios do not look realistic. We don't put you in a scenario where it looks like you're in a crowd of people. We do really evocative things with sound and with light and with colour. And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. we've found that this really makes you feel much more like you're there. I know you know this, but there is something called the uncanny valley, which is as soon as you create a computer-generated environment where you're trying to make something look hyper-real, and the movie studios spend millions on this, but our brains distrust it. We look at it and we think that right. is not human. So we employ some clever tricks like using live motion capture and using actors so that your brain actually says, this is human, it's moving like a human, right. even if it doesn't look completely realistic. So this is always very hard to explain outside of headset, which is why we like to show people before they make a judgment about it. But often, you know, a lot of people will say to us, I was really skeptical because your visual style is very different, but I actually felt like I was in the middle of a protest, or I actually felt like that guy was, you know, coming up to me.
Yeah, and you can see some parts of it on the website too. I mean, I do have an understanding of your visuals because of, obviously it's not in VR, but but you do see something on the website. And I can only imagine, and this is really interesting, also from a company point of view, I can only imagine how much experimenting goes into creating these virtual scenarios from a technological standpoint, of course, but also from an ethical perspective. I mean, how far can you actually go? And you mentioned that some scenarios might be triggering, and that's something you don't want to do, I guess, and what's reasonable. So I'm guessing there's a lot of R&D involved. And
a lot of R&D.
yes. And maybe you can tell us more about these two aspects within your company. One is research and development, which customers always take for granted. I mean, you know, the virtual scenarios should be done, period. But the other is selling the product. So how do you find the balance between researching and then selling? I mean, that must be really difficult.
Yeah. So we were very lucky to benefit from Innovate UK research and development funding. This is the UK government's industrial development strategy. They spend a lot of money on investing in startups to be able to experiment in these kind of spaces. And this was what I was about to say, the other point of difference in our training from the hostile environment training is that it is much more trauma aware. So we had about a 2.5 year research and development process where we worked with psychologists, mental health first aiders. We had a very famous VR psychologist, Dr. Skip Rizzo, who's from the University of Southern California, advising us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he'd done a lot of stuff with virtual reality in the military and PTSD. And so we really had to create, like I said, a safe space where people can experience something where your heart rate does get up and you understand what that feels like in a productive way, with the guardrails around it, which we work with mental health first aid professionals to be able to put those guardrails around it. And I think we've hit that sweet spot where you're understanding how you react under pressure and you're able to practice that, but we're not absolutely, you know, leaving you in a mess on the floor. And so the other thing that we're doing, the other part of the company that is less talked about, is that we research this using biometric data. So we understand, you know, we could link in real time, or we have linked in real time into the scenarios, the ability for you to see your heart rate. But we also worked with MTech Labs, who have very advanced sensing, emotion sensing data that can come into the headset and sort of help you understand how stressed someone is getting. So we're very far from this, but we imagine, you know, a time sort of 5 or 10 years down the track where we can calibrate effectively the amount of stimulus you are getting in order to make it in what we call your Goldilocks zone, so not too hot, not too cold, because everybody's going to react differently, right? You know, especially, you know, we know that especially for journalists, the more you cover stressful events, actually the worse you get at handling stress. And so somebody who's covered a lot of really high-pressure events, while they might not react like someone who's never done that before in the VR, actually emotionally they're already in overload. So they need a very different kind of experience to somebody who's, you know, fresh out of university and, you know, trying to break into the media by covering all of these kind of high-profile events. So we do that manually right now. You know, we very deliberately calibrate how the experience is outside of headset for those groups, but we're heading towards and we are building systems that in an ethical way can show you as a user how your body is responding, and therefore you can practice self-regulation techniques in stressful moments.
Wow. Yeah, so it sounds like you've been researching a lot and you're still very much in the process of it, and you're not planning to stop anytime soon.
No, I would love to go back and do some acts of journalism, but the fact is I'm really far too busy at the moment. Yeah, you know, we, like I said, didn't really mean to leave journalism, but now we have a team and, you know, investors and funders and all sorts of people who are, you know, wanting more content. And so, you know, we have started now building our first humanitarian modules or modules for aid workers. And, you know, this, I think, is just going to keep growing. How far it keeps growing, I don't know. But, yeah, you've correctly identified that we are in the midst of the product development phase. I don't think you ever finish product development. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, unless you're as a founder talking to your clients or, you know, trying to drive sales, then you're wasting your time. So we try and focus quite a lot on that and improving that. So yeah, we're at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And in the beginning of the interview, you mentioned that the pandemic somewhat helped the product development process. Mm. How so?
So we were part of the Bethnal Green Ventures. We had an investment from Bethnal Green Ventures, and they gave. We had a 3-month accelerator program that we conducted, and I had learnt a lot of product development, also agile product development, and mm-hmm. human-centered design techniques from my time at Stanford at the D School, which has been super valuable and just really changed the way I look at any of this. But we were doing this accelerator program and COVID hit, and we were really like, we were just about to launch our first module to journalists. And of course, everyone was in lockdown. We couldn't get headsets at that point to journalists in their houses to test it. And what we had developed was a very realistic looking scenario. And we knew that it wasn't exactly what we wanted. But we thought, let's test it and let's see. And we just couldn't get headsets to people. So we said, okay, do you know what? Let's send journalists the audio and let's see if we get a response, like an emotional response from just the binaural audio. Because, of course, when you are immersed in 360, the audio can come from all directions and it sounds much more realistic. So we did this and we got such strong reactions from people, like, you know, really experienced journalists who covered protests. Oh my God, you put me right back in the middle of XYZ story that I'd covered. And we thought, I mean, this really just gave us confidence that we'd always thought we wanted a much more creative visual style, and everybody from, you know, clients to developers had told us, you're never going to be able to animate a crowd on a mobile headset. It's just not going to happen. The headset won't be able to optimize for it. You'll never make it happen. And so we just sort of started thinking, okay, well, let's strip the visuals right back. And so we really did, relying on the audio first, and then just sort of layered in different visual effects to see how that would feel. And then we worked with a really great mocap studio, Target 3D in London, who helped us incorporate the human movement into that as well. And we had two really great actors who became a whole crowd, because they had to be two actors who lived together because of the COVID restrictions at the time. And so we built this whole protest using essentially two actors. And you would never know it from going through, no spoilers. But this really meant that, like I said, we had the confidence to say, yeah, let's make something really different looking. And everybody who does our first module says, you know, this looks nothing like any other VR training I've ever done, and it feels nothing like any other VR training I've done. It feels something more like a creative sort of installation that you would do. So we're kind of straddling those worlds, that's how COVID actually propelled us in a different direction and a much better direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've mentioned quite a few people that you've been working with, you and your co-founder, Kate, have built an impressive team. I see Unity developers, creative technologists, and sound architects. I think your team is almost 20 people strong already. How do you find your talents? What do you look for when you hire people?
Yeah, it's really tough because these are all really multidisciplinary people, and right. We like to, again, take a really human-centered design approach to this. So everyone has a really different perspective, which means we have some very interesting Friday dev meetings. We were very lucky. Our CTO is the former head of Sony PlayStation VR. He set up PlayStation VR, and so he had a lot of experience in game design and also, you know, distribution for VR at scale. He managed to attract a bunch of people who, you know, he knew as well, so that helps. We worked with a fantastic studio called Fire Panda, Nick Pittam and Jason Story, who are very skilled and very creative developers. They had done an experience that I really loved. It was one of the first things I'd ever done in VR, called Dispatch. It was right back, I think I did it in Oculus Connect 3 conference, and basically it was about a 911 operator, and the visual style was very abstract. They call it a plexus effect, where it's sort of lines and squares that make you think you're looking at a human, but you're not. And so we were very inspired by this, and we just reached out to them and said, hey, how did you do this? And they ended up building what became the first module, and, you know, they're now still working alongside us. So recruitment's difficult, because you really, you know, we naively thought that as filmmakers and journalists we would take a certain skill set into the development of VR, but it's completely different to make a 3D environment to making a 2D film. For a start, you can't control where the user's looking, so it's more about world building rather than creating a different perspective for, you know, as you would as a director of something. So we've had to learn a lot along the way as well. And, it's really been a matter of word of mouth. It's been a matter of asking. I think one of the toughest things as female entrepreneurs is just to ask for what you need. Like, mm-hmm. We were like, you know, can we actually go to these guys and ask them how they do it and will they tell us? And yes, they did. And then, yes, they built us something really great, right, and even better. So, you know, just finding the courage to be able to ask for what you need. Knowing what you need is half of the battle, but then being able to ask, I think, then helps with attracting the right talent to your team, and being able to keep them, you know, with interesting work and interesting projects.
How do you make sure that you can, especially during this pandemic, that you can cultivate some form of company culture? I think as a fairly new company, it is very challenging. I mean, it's not like, you know, we look back at 20 years of working together and, you know, maybe a year won't make such a big difference. But in our companies, you know, there's a lot of fluctuation. And like you said, many multidisciplinary people, and we all have to learn to work together. Do you have any advice on how to manage that well, especially in these times?
I mean, besides our CTO, Simon, and Kate, literally the rest of the company I have never met in person. Can you believe it? So I'm hoping to be able to have my first trip to London in, you know, I don't know, more than 18 months next month. And literally everything else has been via Zoom digitally. So, I mean, Slack is our best friend because you need to be able to quickly, you know, manage a team online. We also have regular, like, stand-up meetings. So the way we, Kate and I, organize our week is that every day of the week is devoted to something, you know, product development days, dev days, you know, finance and ops days, right through to, you know, me and Kate actually having time to chat together as well. But those stand-up meetings are kind of open forums for anyone to attend. So even if you're on the dev team and you want to attend the sales and marketing meeting, you can. So anyone can sort of pop in. And we also, you know, have a policy that if it's not useful to you, you can leave a meeting at any time without saying anything. And so that
leave
just really,
quietly.
Yeah, leave quietly. That really keeps everyone kind of across what each other is doing and what different arms of the company are doing. We also facilitate kind of regular lunch roulettes where you know, someone from one part of the company can talk to someone from the other and get to know them. And Kate and I sort of have a Friday open door coffee or drink session where anyone can pop in and just chat to us about non-work related stuff. But I must admit that even as two people who, you know, communicate for a living, it is a challenge. And, you know, there's always going to be the, you know, someone says something and other people interpret it in a different way. So we've had to become super clear and super specific about what those things are. We do readouts from each of those meetings that then go up on Slack so everyone can see this is what was discussed in the meeting, this is what's going to happen as a result, and this is when it's going to get done. Otherwise, it just becomes really, really unruly.
So, yeah, we actually also established, besides the daily stand-up, a morning check-in where we can just... Like the title says, you can just check in the morning and you can talk about non-work related stuff. And it's actually our alternative to coming into the office and, you know, just having a little chit chat.
Yeah, you miss the water cooler conversation, right? And
definitely,
as a manager, it feels like, you know, you want to be checking in, not checking up, you know. So, and there's a fair degree of trust and flexibility as well. Like, we don't care when people work as long as they get what they need to do done and that they can, you know, attend the meetings and communicate it when needed.
And you mentioned Slack, and I wonder what other communication tools you're using. So is email basically off the table, or do you also communicate via email?
We have to email clients, but we don't really email each other. Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize until we just onboarded another colleague with a journalism kind of humanitarian background, and she's a very similar background to Kate and I, and she was like, oh my gosh, you guys use so many tools. Mm-hmm. We hadn't realized how many tools we had gathered.
That's the same experience that we've had. After a while, you just start using Keybase and Slack and Trello and Fabricator. Yeah. And
that's it. We've got, so the core team, like the C-suite, uses Trello as well, and the dev team has their own Trello. Mm-hmm. And we just have different channels on Slack where we try and streamline that, but not the whole team needs to be across Trello, because I think Trello works with a small group, but it's less effective when you grow. Then I think, we also use Miro, the virtual whiteboards, a lot. I think I'm in Miro and Canva every day, and most of our development priorities all happen on Miro because it's visual and we're all visual people. Mm-hmm. And so I can look at any Miro board and sort of see where the dev team is up to because, you know, they're visually kind of showing things. Mm-hmm. And what else do we use a lot? We use Canva for presentations, and that's sort of more on a sales and marketing and external communication standpoint. We do have to email people, most of the clients, because they're all still on email. And I think, and then Google, everything is right. In the cloud. Google Drive is kind of, if our Google Drive ever goes down, we're really in trouble. So that's probably not a great thing, but for now, that's the best kind of real-time collaborative tool that we can use across the team.
Mm. And when did you make the switch from, I mean, you already said 2018, but in your head, I'm guessing it was already before that. When did you make the switch from being a journalist to becoming an entrepreneur? What triggered you, or what inspired you to do that?
I still think I'm a journalist. I still describe myself as a journalist.
And I did too.
Someone in my new co-working space said, what do you do? I say, I'm a journalist. but I guess I haven't really committed an act of journalism for about, you know, 2 or 3 years now. Mm-hmm. So I very reluctantly give up the journalism title, Linda. I guess that probably the end of 2019 was the point at which I really thought, okay, now we've got to double down on this and try and make it work, otherwise it's not going to. The longer I am outside of being in a media organization, the more I wonder how I'm ever going to be able to go back to one.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, the answer is probably the last 2 years I've been much more an entrepreneur than a journalist. I love what I do because I'm learning something new every day. Mm-hmm. There's no way, you know, even as a freelancer and running a production company, you don't learn anything like the business kind of mindset that you learn in a startup.
Yeah.
And so that's great. I wonder how long I'm going to want to do all the management side of it. The thing that I enjoy most is still the world building, the scripting, the creating. But as you grow, less and less of your time as a CEO can be devoted to that.
Yeah.
Other people get to do those fun tasks. what would have really benefited me at the beginning, in the days where you're like, is this even going to work? This could all just flop. We're existing on grant funding alone.
Right.
Was kind of a bit of a journey map, I guess, whereby, you know, you kind of understand that you will grow this company to a certain point, and then an exit doesn't have to look like what investors say an exit
is. Exactly, yeah.
You know, I found that particularly if you do accelerator programs, et cetera, they tend to put you in front of VCs who talk about growth for growth's sake. And I was always saying, yeah, but what about just like, you know, what does abundance look like? What does it look like if you run a sustainable company where everybody's paid well and everybody's happy and you're not just, you know, trying to not just take a slice of the pie, but take all of the pie, which is what VCs will talk to you about. So I think I really would have benefited from understanding that you don't have to do it like everybody else does. You can create the kind of company and the kind of culture and the kind of growth strategy that will help you get it to the point you want to get it to. Right now we're very focused on raising a seed round, and that will be mostly with angel investors at the start of next year. And then, you know, beyond that, it'll be really interesting to get the company to Series A. But beyond that, I don't know that we are the people to lead the company once it gets to that stage. But all of this has been really exciting and is really exciting, and we're extremely passionate about it. So we'll keep going for as long as we can make it keep going.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I actually was watching an interview with Mark Zuckerberg the other day, and he said a long time ago that he thinks that the best companies are the companies run by the people who actually started the companies, because there is a certain passion behind them, obviously, or else they wouldn't have started the company. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to manage everything, because you can still get people who manage the company, but you're still the head of, you know, the company that people can look up to. Even the people who work for you can, you know, can look at you and say, okay, we have a CEO who believes in it, who started this. I think it's...
I mean, Mark Zuckerberg would have to say that, wouldn't he? because he's
still the head of his company. It's a bad example, I think it's a valid point.
Yeah, it's a valid point. I think it also leaves you some blind spots. And I think, again, using the Mark Zuckerberg example, I think there are some massive blind spots in because he is still the head of his company. So, you know, for instance, this whole mission of connecting the world, oh, isn't that great? Well, I was actually working in Myanmar when it first had its political opening. Now it's all, you know, gone backwards again. But, you know, connecting the world there meant enabling genocidal tendencies to come to the fore very quickly. And so I think it's difficult striking a balance. And of course, employees will really want to work at companies where the CEO, you know, knows the nuts and bolts of it and has the vision, and it's very exciting in those early days. But if you are going to go for particularly the bigger rounds of funding, then I think there's a point, and I don't know what that point is because I'm far from it, but there is a point at which it's not helpful for you to be controlling everything. And maybe that's what he was saying by, you know, you can have other people who manage, etc. But yeah, I mean, I think what we're saying is essentially the same thing. Vision and direction and values and purpose are very, very important in any company, but especially a growth company where you're trying to get something off the ground and drive some sort of innovation or change to the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just mentioned the work that you were doing as a Jonas Knight Fellow. You were working on a solution for hate speech in social media, especially on Facebook, on Myanmar. And I was watching some interviews with you, and you stressed the fact that Silicon Valley platforms need to understand their impact in different cultural context. I hope I'm framing this right. And this was, I think, in 2014. And I think in 2018, this matter actually became news, at least in Germany. I didn't read about it before, because Facebook actually admitted that the platform was used to incite violence, especially attacking the Rohingya and other Muslim communities. And you also produced an immersive 360 video called I Am Rohingya. And back then, still as a journalist, how would you say immersive journalism helped you tell better stories, strictly from a journalistic point of view now?
Do you want the truth?
Please, yes.
I don't know that it did, which was part of the reason. I mean, yeah, again, very graciously, you're saying I was looking at solutions to this hate speech problem. I obviously didn't do... I wasn't looking at solutions. I was more raising the alarm right. about it happening. This is one of my big, not regrets, but one of my big missed opportunities, I think, to have created more impact as a journalist, which was that if I had, you know, I was kind of the only one shouting about the fact that Facebook was creating a platform for... A, fake news, and B, hate speech at that time, and that the architecture of it was actually really problematic. It was designed by, you know, college kids in the US, or designed for college kids in the US, and then it grew to this global platform. And, you know, actually in an emerging democracy, it was more harmful than beneficial in many ways. And no one was really listening, and grabbing that opportunity and actually creating a solution would have been something that, not as a journalist, but maybe as an entrepreneur, I could have, should have, would have done, because no one expected, you know, that what I was saying would then become reality in, you know, stable Western democracies quite so quickly, but it did. So I Am Rohingya was a 360 video that I made with Al Jazeera's studios, VR studios, quite a while ago, and that was my first experience as a creator making immersive content. And I guess I saw, you know, the benefit of people being able to immerse in this camp and understand. I thought they would empathize a lot more than they did with the characters in it. I do think there is something powerful about that, and that's why I continued working in immersive tech, but it didn't create the groundswell of reaction that I hoped it would have. And that could be because of a lot of reasons, you know, not the least distribution. You know, people don't have VR headsets in their houses in the same way that they have television screens. And if you think about, you know, the infrastructure and the technology that we needed to be able to put a screen in everybody's living room and take content to them, right now VR content is still not at that point, and I don't know that it will reach that point. So, you know, immersing, yes, and making people, giving people a sense of the 3D space around them, yes, but telling the story better, I still feel the jury is out. I think 2D, like regular documentaries, can do in many ways a much better job than those kind of immersive 360 experiences. And I think, I don't know that that'll be the case forever, but it that experience really prompted me to make better VR that would create a change. And I really sort of steered away from 360 content after that, because you can't do anything, and essentially 360 environments, you know, you want to be able to interact in some way at least, even if it's a small way. And I did, you know, watch my user research from that film. People would try and talk to the characters and they would try and interact. And so, yeah, it's that difference between filmmaking and world building. And I think a lot of people rush to 360 video to try and do the same that they do with 2D video. And I made all those same mistakes. And I think I think we can do more than that. We can reach higher than that with immersive content. Mm-hmm. And we can create better user experiences than sort of standing there looking around. That's not to say that 360 video as a medium doesn't do that. There have been some very good 360 films that I think have managed to create that. But I just feel that for journalism, you know, you even see it in, you know, the New York Times project where they were releasing a piece of 360 content every week. You know, they just don't have the distribution and the uptake of that yet. And people don't have the visual language, if you like. You know, we know how the visual language of television works and of film works. We're not yet at the stage where we know what the visual language as audiences are for VR. And I think that's still being developed.
Yeah, I was going to say it's... there are no standards yet, yeah, from the creator's point of view, but also from the recipient's point of view. We don't have the, I guess, the media literacy in that respect. I don't know, but it's
as creators or as consumers. To be frank, I mean, traveling around for years watching VR at different festivals, I also think it was very badly done in a lot of ways. You know, if you're, you know, an immersive environment is incredibly evocative, much more so than watching a screen. But if you kind of put a VR headset on somebody without the kind of warnings and flags and, you know, without telling them what to expect, I think we really have a very strong impetus as creators to be able to explain the work and allow people to opt in rather than kind of using it to shock people. And so we're very conscious about onboarding, offboarding, letting people know what they're getting into before they do, without spoiling it, obviously. But you really need to be conscious about that. And I think particularly when you're making 360 content, you know, there's all sorts of ethical questions that we need to be considering about, like, how, what are the ethics of us as creators showing somebody's house in a camp? You know, we can't just go and film it and like we do for a documentary and then show a particular view of it. It's when you're actually immersing people in that person's actual living room. I think it's a different thing and it needs to be treated differently.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess that's the learning curve we're all experiencing right now. And I remember 5-6 years ago, we talked about VR completely different. We were so enthusiastic and, you know, we were telling ourselves, this is going to revolutionize, you know, the state of journalism, basically. And yesterday, I was reading this tweet by Ada Rose Cannon. I don't know if you know her. And she basically said VR and to a lesser extent AR is no longer the hot new hype thing. Boring but competently omnipresent is where the web thrives the most. It's, I don't know, it feels like VR and VR technologies are now maturing. And, you know, we by now have cell phones that can, how do you say, that can work with the VR experiences that we put out as creators. But the people are... We lost the people, I feel like. Nobody's really interested in immersive storytelling any longer, which I guess is one reason why a lot of media companies have stopped producing them, at least on a daily basis.
Well, I think the distribution headache is the other thing. Like, how do you get it to people, you know, outside of showing it in a festival that maybe 100 people will see? I think, yeah, I'm a VR creator and I never want to just put on my headset to watch a news story. Mm-hmm. I will put it on to do other things like meet people, talk to people. We have meetings in VR quite regularly. Mm-hmm. And I think we've ended up, Kate and I, in the use case of training and education because I think there it's an extremely powerful tool. And maybe you're right. Maybe the... it will just be these kind of more, quote, boring use cases will be the thing that makes VR more mainstream. It'll be the thing that's in the office or the thing that's in the special studio that you go to, like a cinema, but it won't be something that everyone has in their homes. I don't know. I do think there is a slow creep, though, towards people becoming more familiar with the technology through these other use cases, and eventually there will be a time when people do go to it for their news content. I just think no one's really cracked the distribution or the delivery effectively yet. AR is doing a much better job of reaching the masses, and I think that's also going to help. And so, it's still the Wild West. we're still figuring it out, which is why I said your introduction was very generous, because I don't feel like I know the answers to any of this. But if anyone out there does, please feel free to get in touch.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like you have a very good, like I said, a very good understanding of what the future holds. And I can't wait to walk and experience this transition right now, and also observing what Headset is doing. And I'm really looking forward to reading and seeing and experiencing more about coming from your studio.
We definitely want you in our first courses in Germany, Linda. You're welcome to
attend. I cannot wait. Yes, I would love to attend, yes. Ella, so many more things to talk about, but I guess we're running out of time. So I want to say thank you so much for taking the time and introducing your studio to us and telling us more about the VR ecosystem and where we are right now and talking about your company. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Really appreciate the opportunity, Linda. Thank you.